what seemed a mouth, a round mouth of elastic, shifting shape, a mouth seeking to be a mouth. The great mass of crimson-tinted tentacles now filled the mirror to the very frame. The face grew bigger, and it seemed the mouth, which was only a dark cipher, stretched into a smile. The eyes flashed black and filled with life. Bigger and bigger grew the face, as though the being were indeed still moving towards me, moving towards the barrier of this glass that divided us, and the face slowly grew to be the size, perhaps, of my own. The dark eyes expanded, took on the human accoutrements of eyelashes and eyebrows, a semblance of a nose appeared, and the mouth had lips. The whole mirror now was filled with the deep, pellucid red of this image, a soft, elusive red, the colour of blood suffusing the tubular tentacles and the face, the slowly darkening face.
"Hamel!"
I cried out. I gasped for breath. The dark eyes grew pupils as they looked at me, and lips smiled as the opening had smiled before. An expression bloomed on the surface of the face, an expression of unutterable love. Pain fused with the love, undeniable pain. The expression of pain and love so fused in the face that I could hardly bear to look at it, aware suddenly of a huge pain inside me, inside my heart, pain blooming in me as if it were unstoppable, out of all control, and would soon be more than I could bear.
"I love you,"
I said.
"I love you."
And then without words I reached out towards it. I reached out, and I told it that I would embrace it, I would know it, I would take into myself its love, its pain.
"I will take into myself what you are."
I heard the sound of weeping, only it had no sound. I heard it rising all around me the way the sound of falling rain can rise as it strikes more and more surfaces around one, pattering on streets and roofs and leaves and boughs.
"I know what's driven you to these things,"
I said aloud. I was crying. My eyes were filling with blood.
"I would never have hurt that boy," whispered the voice inside me.
Only it was coming from this face, this tragic face, these lips, this one looking into my eyes.
"I believe you,"
I said.
"I will never hurt you.
I will give you all that I know," I said, "if only you'll do the same with me. If only we can love one another, always, completely. I will not suffer you to go into any other but me."
"Yes,"
he said,
"you have always been my beloved, always, dancer, singer, oracle, high priest, prince."
I reached out for the mirror, slapping my hands on the glass. The eyes were huge, and the mouth was long and serene, with curving lips, expressive lips.
"In one body," said the voice, "in one brain, in one soul."
A sigh came from it, a long, agonizing sigh.
"Don't fear me. Don't fear my suffering, my cries, my frantic power. Help me. Help me, I beg you. You are my redeemer. Call me forth from the tomb."
I reached out with every fiber of my being, my hands pressing the glass, shuddering against it, my whole soul wanting to pass into the mirror, into the bloody red image, into the face, into the voice. And then the image was gone. I found myself on the carpet, sitting there, as if I'd been pushed or fallen backwards, staring up at the bright, empty mirror, reflecting again the contents of the room. There was a knocking at the door. Somewhere a clock was striking the hour. So many chimes. Was it possible? I rose to my feet and went to the door. It was midnight. The last chime had just echoed through the hallway. Gregory and Seth and Severin were there. Farid was with them, and David and Jesse and Marius. Others were nearby. What had drawn them here now, just now? I was dazed. What could I say to them?
"There is so much we want to talk about," said Gregory, We're not hearing the voice. None of us are. The world's quiet, or so it tells Benji upstairs. But surely this is only an intermezzo. We must plan.
I stood there quietly for a long moment, hands clasped just under my chin. I lifted my right hand, one finger raised.
Am I your leader? I asked.
It was so hard for me to speak, to form the simplest words.
Will you accept my decision as to the disposition of the voice?
No one answered for a moment. I couldn't shake off the languor I felt. I couldn't rally. I wanted them all to leave me now. Then Gregory said softly,
But what possible disposition for the voice can there be? The voice is the body of Makari. Makari is quiet now. The voice is quiet. But the voice will begin to scheme again. The voice will plot.
This creature, Makari, said Severin, she is a living thing. She knows, in some brutal and simple way, she knows her tragedies. I tell you, she knows.
Seems Farid said something about reasoning with the voice, but I scarcely heard him.
Seth asked me if I was hearing the voice.
You are communing with it, aren't you?
But you sealed yourself off from us.
You're battling the voice alone.
So this is the decision you want from me? I asked. That the voice remain with Mekare?
What other decision can there be for now? Asked Severin. And whoever else takes this voice into himself risks being driven mad by it. And how can anyone seize Amel from Mekare without ending her life? We have no recourse but to reason with it as it lives inside of her.
I drew myself up.
I had to appear alert, even if I was not, in control of my faculties, even if I was not. I was by no means irrational. It's simply that I had to return to a state of examining these things on my own, which I could not share. Gregory was trying to read my thoughts. They all were. But I knew too well how to lock them out. And in the dark little sanctum of my heart, I saw that blood-red face, that suffering face. I beheld it in pure wonder.
Put aside your fears, I said.
My tongue was thick, and I didn't sound like myself to me. I looked directly at Gregory, then at Seth, then at each of the others insofar as I could see them, even at Marius, who reached out to grasp my arm.
I want to be alone now.
I removed Marius's hand from me. The Latin words came to me.
Nolite timere, I said.
I gestured for patience as I started to close the door. Slowly they withdrew. Marius bent forward to kiss me, and he told me that they would all be in the house till morning. No one was leaving, everyone was here, and that when we were ready to talk with them further, they'd come together at once.
Tomorrow night, said Marius, at the hour of 9, Victor and Rose will be brought over by Pandora and me.
Ah, yes, I answered. That's good. I smiled. At last, the door was shut once again, and I moved back into the room. I sat down again on the leather ottoman of one of the chairs, near to the fire. Moments passed, perhaps half an hour. Now and then I drew to myself the random sounds of the house and the great metropolis beyond, and then banished those sounds as if I were a magnet at the center of a consciousness greater than myself. It seemed the hallway clock struck the hour. Chimes, and chimes, and chimes. And then after the longest time the clock chimed yet again. The house was quiet. Only Benji's voice went on way up there in his studio, talking gently and patiently to the young ones, those isolated on far continents and in far cities, still desperate for the comfort of his words. Easy to close myself off from that. And the clock chiming again, as if it were an instrument being played by my hand. I did like clocks, I had to admit it. There came that vision of sunshine and green fields, the soft musical sound of the insects humming, and the soft rustle of trees. The twins sat together, and Maharit said something to me in the soft, ancient tongue that I thought very amusing and very comforting, but the words were gone as fast as they'd come, if there had ever been words before. There was a slow trudging step in the hall beyond the door. a heavy step that made the old boards creak, and the deep sound of a powerful beating heart. The door opened slowly, and Makare appeared. She'd been lovingly restored since last night, and wore a black wool robe trimmed in silver. Her long hair was brushed and clean and lustrous, and someone had also fastened a fine collar of diamonds and silver around her neck. The sleeves of the gown were long and full, and the robe draped exquisitely on her, on the girlish body that was now a thing of stone. Her face was fiercely white in the light of the fire. Her pale blue eyes were fixed on me, but the flesh around them was softened as it had always been. The fire glinted on her golden eyelashes, on her golden eyebrows, and on her white hands and face. She came towards me with those slow steps as if the effort cost her body pain, pain that she did not acknowledge, but pain which slowed her every movement. She took her place in front of me, the fire just to her right. "You want to go to your sister, don't you?" I asked. Very slowly, her pink lips, so very like the pink insides of a seashell, spread into a smile, the mask-like face fired with subtle perception. I rose to my feet. My heart was pounding. She lifted her two hands, palms turned inwards, and gradually brought her fingers to her eyes. With her left hand poised, she reached with her right hand for her right eye. I gasped, but it was done before I could stop her, and the blood was pouring down her cheek, the eye gone, plucked out and fallen to the floor, and only the empty, bleeding socket was there, and then her fingers, the first two fingers, once more jabbed into the blood and broke the tender occipital bones at the back of the eye socket. I heard the little cone of bones snap and shatter. I understood. She reached out to me, imploring me, and out of her there came a low, desperate sigh. I took her head in my hands and closed my lips on the bleeding eye socket. I felt her powerful hands caressing my head. I sucked with all my strength, drawing as strongly as ever I'd drawn blood in my life, and I felt the brain coming into my mouth, flowing viscous and sweet as the blood, flowing out of her and coming into me. I felt it fill my mouth, a great gusher of tissue against all the tender flesh inside my mouth, and then filling my throat as it passed down into me. The world went dark, black, and then it exploded with light. All I could see was this light. Galaxies exploded in this light. Whole, sweeping pathways of innumerable stars pulsed and disintegrated as the light grew brighter and brighter. I heard my own distant cry. Her body had gone limp in my arms, but I wouldn't let it go. I held fast, drawing on the blood, drawing on the gusher of tissue, drawing and drawing, and hearing the beat of her heart swell to deafening volume and then stop. I swallowed again and again, until nothing but blood was in my mouth. My own heart exploded. I felt her body fall to the floor, but I saw nothing. Blackness again. Blackness. Disaster. And then the light, the blinding light. I lay on the floor, my arms and legs outstretched, and a great searing current was moving through my limbs, through my organs, through the chambers of my heart. It pervaded every cell of my skin, all over my body, my arms, my legs, my face, my head. Like electricity, it burned through every circuit of my being. The light flashed and brightened. My arms and legs were flopping, and I couldn't control them, but the sensations were orgasmic, and they had become my body. All heavy tissue and bone suddenly gathered up into this weightless yet glorious thing that I was. My body had become this light, this throbbing, pulsing, shivering light, this simmering light. And I felt as if it were pouring out of me through my fingers and my toes, through my cock, through my skull. I could feel it generated and regenerated inside me, inside my pounding heart, and pouring out so that I seemed immense, immense beyond all imagining, expanding in a void of light, light that was blinding, light that was beautiful, light that was perfect. I cried out again. I heard it, but never meant to do it. I heard it. Then the light flashed as if to blind me forever, and I saw the ceiling above me, and I saw the circle of the chandelier, the flashing, prismatic colors of that chandelier. The room came down around me as if descending from heaven, and I was not on the floor at all. I was standing on my feet. Never in all my existence had I felt so powerful. Not even ascending with a cloud gift had I ever known such fearlessness, such buoyancy, such limitless and utterly sublime strength. I was climbing to the stars, yet I had not left the room. I stared down at Macari. She was dead. She had sunk to her knees and then fallen on her right side, her blighted eye socket hidden, her left profile perfect as she lay there staring forward with one half-lidded blue eye as if she were asleep. How beautiful she looked, how complete, how like a flower fallen there on the gravel path of a garden, how destined for this fragile moment. The sound of wind filled my ears. Wind and singing, as if I'd passed into realms of angels. And then voices assailed me, voices from everywhere, rising and falling in waves, relentless voices, voices in splashes, as if someone were splashing the very walls of my entire universe with great splashes of molten gold paint. "Are you with me?" I whispered. "I am with you," he said clearly, distinctly in my brain. "Do you see what I see? It's magnificent. Do you hear what I hear? It's magnificent." "I see as never before," I said. "As do I." We were wrapped in a cloud of sound together, immense, unending, and symphonic sound. I looked down at my hands. They were throbbing, as was all my body, as was the whole brilliant world. Never had they seemed such a miracle of texture and perfection. "Are these your hands?" I asked. "They are mine," he said calmly. I turned to the mirror. "Are these your eyes?" I asked, staring into my own. "They are mine." I gave a long, low sigh. "We are beautiful, you and I," he said. Behind me in the glass, behind my still, awestruck face, I saw them all. They had all come into the room. I turned to face them. Every single one of them was gathered here now, from right to left. They were astonished. They looked at me, not a single one speaking. Not a single one looking with surprise or horror at the body of Macari on the floor. They had seen it. They had seen it in their minds. They'd seen it, and they knew. I had not shed her precious blood. I had not done her violence. I had accepted her invitation. All of them knew what had happened. They'd felt it, inescapably, just as I'd felt it on that long-ago day when Macari took the core from Akasha. Never had they, or any gathering of persons, looked so very distinct to me. Each individual there radiant with a subtle power, each stamped with a signature of distinct and defining energy, each marked with a unique gift. I couldn't stop looking at them, marveling at the details of their faces, at their delicate flashing expressions playing over eyes and lips.
"Well, Prince Lestat," cried Benji, "it is done." "You are our prince," said Seth.
"You are anointed now," said Severin.
"You were chosen," said Gregory, "by him and by her, by him who animates all of us, and by the one who was our queen of the damned."
Amel laughed softly inside me. "You are my beloved," he whispered. I stood silent, feeling a slow, subtle movement inside of my body, as if some fine tangle of tendrils were moving purposefully out of my brain and down the length of my spine, and then out again through my limbs. I could see this as I felt it, see its subtle, golden electric pulse. Out of the depths of my soul that was the sad and struggling sum of all I'd ever known, I felt my own voice yearning to say, "And I will never be alone again." "No, you will never," said the voice. "You will never be alone again." I looked at the others once more, all gathered there so expectantly and in awe. I could see the muted wonder in Marius, and the quiet, sad trust in Louis, and the childlike amazement in Armand. I saw their doubts, their suspicions, their questions, also uneasily subsumed in the moment by wonder. I knew. And how could I ever explain how I had reached this moment? I, who had been born to darkness of rape, and sought for redemption in a borrowed mortal body, and followed spirits yet unexplained to realms of inexplicable heaven and nightmarish hell, only to fall back again to the brutal earth, broken and battered and defeated. How to explain why this alone was the bold and terrifying alliance that would give me the passion to travel the road of the centuries, of the millennia, of the eons of uncharted and unimagined time? "I will not be the prince of the damned," I said. "I give no power to that old poetry. No, never. We claim now the devil's road as our road, and we will rename it for ourselves and our tribe and our journey. We are reborn." "Prince Lestat," said Benji again, and then Cybele echoed it, and then Antoine, and Louis, and Armand, and Marius, and Gregory, Seth, Farid, Rochamandis, Everard, Benedict, Severin, Bianca, Notka, all of them echoed it, and on the words kept coming from those for whom as yet I had no names. Victor stood in the shadows with Rose, and Victor said it, and so did Rose, and Benji shouted it again, throwing up his hands and bawling his fists. "They are beautiful," said Amel. "These children of me, these parts of me, this tribe of me." "Yes, beloved, they have always been that," I answered. "That has always been true." "So beautiful," he said again. "How can we not love them?" "Oh, but we do," I said. "We certainly do."
Part 4. The Principality of Darkness. 28. Lestat. The Prince's Speech.
My first true decision as monarch was that I wanted to go home to France. This monarch was going to rule from his ancestral Chateau de Liancourt on one of the most isolated mountain plateaus of the Massif Central, where he had been born. And it was also decided that Armand's luxurious house in Saint-Germain-des-Prés would henceforward be the Paris headquarters of the court. Trinity Gate would be the royal residence in New York, and we would have the ceremony for Rose and Victor tomorrow night at Trinity Gate as planned. An hour after the transformation, when I was at last ready for it, we took the remains of Macari from the library and buried them in the rear garden, in a spot surrounded by flowers and open to the sun in the day. We were all to a one gathered for this, including Rochamandis and Benedict. Macari's body had turned to something resembling clear plastic, though I detest the crudeness of that word. What blood she'd retained had pooled as she lay on the floor, and her remains were largely completely translucent by the time we carried her to her grave. Even her hair was becoming colourless, and breaking apart into myriad silver needle-like fragments. So Severin and my mother and the other women laid her out on a bier for the burial, placing the missing eye back into its socket, and covered her over with black velvet. We stood silent at the side as she was laid to rest in what was a shallow but completely adequate grave.
Flower petals were gathered by some of us from throughout the garden, and these were sprinkled over the bier. Then others gathered more flowers. I turned back the velvet one last time and bent down to kiss Macari's forehead. Rosamandes and Benedict did nothing, because they obviously feared the censure of all if they tried to make any gesture. And Everard de Landen, the French-Italian fledgling of Rosamandes, was the last to place several roses on the corpse. Finally we began to fill the grave with earth, and soon all sight of Macari's form was lost. It was agreed that two of those vampire physicians working for Seth and Farid would go to the Amazon compound and exhume whatever remained of Cayman and Maharet, and bring those relics here to be laid to rest with Macari, sometime in the coming month. And of course I knew full well that Farid and Seth would harvest samples from those remains. Possibly they had done it with Macari, but then again perhaps not, as this was a solemn occasion. David and Jesse would also go there to retrieve whatever had survived of Maharet's library and archives, of her keepsakes and belongings, and any legal papers that were worth preserving for her mortal family, or for Jesse herself. I found all this unrelievedly grim, but I noticed that the others, to a one, seemed comforted by these arrangements. It took me back to the night long ago when Akasha had died at the hand of Macari. I realized with shame I had not the slightest idea what had become of her corpse. Not to care, not to question, not to bother, all this had been part of the old way for me, one of shame and melancholy, an existence in which I assumed completely that we were cursed and the victims of the blood, as surely as mortals thought themselves to be the guilty victims of original sin. I had not seen us as worthy of ceremonies. I had not believed in the small coven that Armand had sought to rescue from those ghastly nights when he created the old night island for us to gather in the Florida climes. Well, I saw the sense of all this now. I saw its immense value for the old and the young. I had been tired before the momentous change had been worked, and elated as I was, and the word does little justice to what I felt, I was still tired and needing to be alone now. Alone with Amel. But before I retired for the night back to the French library, I felt we had to meet in the attic ballroom once more around the long, rectangular gilded table that was still in place, as it had been for our first assembly. For one thing, every single immortal inhabitant of the household was watching me, trying to figure how Amel was infecting and affecting me, and I knew this, and so I had no hesitation about spending more time with them now. So we returned to the long golden table and chairs. I stood at the head as before. Rose and Victor kept to the wall with those retiring blood-drinkers brought to Trinity Gate by Notker and Severin, whom I was determined to come to know before I left this place. Whatever it might have been like for Akasha or Macari to hold the core, I couldn't know. But for me, having Amel inside of me multiplied and expanded my senses and my energy beyond measure. I still saw each of them and all of them when I looked at the assembly in a new and remarkably vivid way. "I think this ballroom should be the place for Rose and Victor to receive the dark gift," I said. "The table should be broken up and its parts put back on the periphery. I think the place should be filled with all the flowers from the shops of Manhattan that it can hold. Armand's local mortal agents can surely see to this during the daylight hours." He at once agreed. "And I suggest that all be present under the roof, but not in this room, leaving this room alone to Rose and to Victor and Pandora and Marius for the giving of the gift." No one objected. "Then, at such a time as the ceremony is complete, others may be invited up, one by one, to give their ancient blood. Gregory, Severin, Seth. Perhaps you will agree to this. Marius and Pandora, you will approve. Rose and Victor, you will be willing. And I will give you a measure of my blood then, too." Agreement all around. "Marius and Pandora can then take the fledglings down to the garden," I said, "for the physical death and its pain. And when that's past, they can be clothed in new garments and come into the house reborn. After that, Marius and Pandora can take our young ones out to experience the hunt for the first time." Again there was obvious and enthusiastic agreement. Rosamandes asked for permission to speak. I gave it.
His arm and his hand had been working perfectly since their reattachment, with no problem whatsoever, as I knew they'd be, and he was handsomely clothed in a tailored grey leather jacket and a sweater of lighter grey wool. He looked cool and collected and charming, as if he'd never hacked anyone to death or kidnapped anyone or threatened to kill my son if he didn't get his way. "I can well understand if no one wants me to do more than be a quiet prisoner here," he said. "But I will give my blood to the young couple if they will accept it, and maybe this can go towards my forgiveness by this group." Victor and Rose waited on me for my response, and I, after looking intently at Rochamandis and Benedict for a long moment, noting the dazzling equanimity of the former and the obvious abject misery of the latter, said yes to this if Marius and Pandora approved, and if Victor and Rose gave their consent. "Understand? I could hardly believe myself that I was doing this, but the prince was in charge now, and the brat prince was no more. The motion carried, so to speak." "I am sorry from my heart," said Rochamandis, with amazing calmness. "I have truly in my long life among the undead never sought conflict, even when others thought I should. I am sorry. I lost my own fledglings to the children of Satan rather than make war. I ask the tribe to forgive me, and to accept me as one of its own." Benji was staring at him with fierce, narrow black eyes, and Armand was looking up at me from his chair with slightly raised eyebrows, and Jessie merely looked at him coldly, her arms folded. David had no discernible expression, but I felt I knew what he was thinking, even though I couldn't read his thoughts. "What precisely are we to do with this one if we don't accept him back into the tribe? And what danger is he to anyone if we do?" "Well, as I saw it, he was no danger. If he was not accepted, well, then he might become a danger, especially if others took this to mean that he had been proscribed, like the ancient enemies of the dictator Sulla, who were then free game to be murdered by their Roman brethren. I was no Sulla." I listened quietly for the voice of Amel, conscious that I wanted very much to know what he had to say. All had changed between us, so totally that he was no longer even the specter in my mind of the old voice. But if I had underestimated the complexity of all this, I did want a hint of that now. In the silence I heard his faint whisper, "I used him. Can we not be thankful that he failed?" "Very well," I said. I turned to Rochamandis. "I say your apology is accepted. You are a member of this tribe. I can see no threat from you now to anyone here. Who disagrees with me on this? Speak up, or forever be quiet." No one spoke up, but there were tears in the eyes of the regal, ashen-haired Alessandra when I said this, and Rochamandis nodded and took his seat. I'm not sure anyone but I caught Everard's sharp, personal glance to me, and the confidential negative shake of his head. Benedict looked confused, and so I directed my remarks to him. "You are now once more in good standing," I said. "Whatever you did, and whyever you did it, all this is now closed." But I knew this was small comfort to him. He'd live for years with the horror of what he'd done. It was by that time almost 4 a.m., and sunrise would occur in slightly over 2 hours. I stood silent at the head of the table. I could feel all these eyes on me, as fixed and probing as ever, but I felt most keenly the scrutiny of Seth and Farid, though why, I wasn't sure. "We have much to do," I said, "all of us, to establish what it means for us and for all those blood drinkers out there, the world over, that we are now one proud tribe. One proud people of darkness, one proud race that seeks to prosper on this earth. And as it has fallen to me to rule, by invitation and by unique selection, I want to rule from my home in the Auvergne. I live now in my father's castle there, almost fully restored, a great stone edifice, including as many comfortable chairs as this amazing house in which we are gathered now. And I will be your prince." I paused to let the point be absorbed. Then I went on. "Prince Lestat I will be," I said. "That is the term that's been offered to me over and over in one form or another, it seems. and my court shall be in my castle, and I invite all of you to come there and help forge the constitution and the rules by which we live. I will need your help in deciding a multitude of questions, and I will delegate to those of you who are receptive various tasks to help us move to a new and glorious existence, which I hope that all the blood drinkers of the world will come to share. Benji was now close to tears.
Oh, if only this were being recorded, he declared.
Sibel told him to be quiet, and Armand was laughing silently at him, but also motioning for him to restrain himself. You may report my words in full whenever you wish, I said. You have my express permission. With a subtle gesture, he opened his spiffy little jacket to reveal an iPhone peeping out of his inner pocket. Marius, I said, turning to him, I ask that you write for us all the rules by which you've lived and prospered for centuries, as I've never found anyone more ethical in these matters than you are.
I'll do my best with this, said Marius.
And Gregory, I said, Gregory, you who have survived with such astonishing success in the mortal world, I ask that you help to establish a code by which blood drinkers can effectively interact with mortals to preserve their material wealth, as well as their secrecy. Please give us the benefit of all you've learned. I have much to share on this, and so does Armand, but you are the past master.
I'm more than willing, said Gregory.
We must assist the most befuddled fledgling out there in obtaining whatever papers and documents are required to move from place to place in the physical world. We must do our best to halt the creation of a class of desperate vampiric tramps and marauders. Benji was beside himself with excitement at all these proceedings, but he was shocked when I turned now to him.
And you, Benjamin, obviously you must be our Minister of Communications from now on, and wherever in the world I am, I will be in communication with you here at your headquarters every night. We must talk, you and I, about the radio program and the website, and what more we can do together through the Internet to gather the lost sheep in the blood.
Yes, he said with obvious joy. He lifted his fedora in salute to me, and it was the first time that I'd seen his adorable little round face and cap of curly black hair for what they were.
Notker, I said, you brought your musicians here, your singers, your violinists, and they've joined with Sibel and with Antoine, and given us the extraordinary pleasure that only blood-drinker musicians and artists can give. Will you come with me to my court in the Auvergne and help to create my court orchestra and my court choir? I want this with my whole heart.
Oh, my prince, I'm at your service, said Nordker, and my own humble fiefdom is only minutes away from you in the Alps.
Seth and Farid, I said, you are our physicians, our scientists, our bold explorers. What can I do? What can all of us do to support you in your ongoing work?
Well, I think you know, said Seth. There's much we can learn from you and from Amal.
Understatement. Burning eyes. You'll have my complete cooperation always, I said. And you'll have your rooms at my court and whatever else you need or desire. And I will be open to you and offer you whatever knowledge or experience that I can. Farid was smiling, obviously pleased, and Seth was satisfied for the moment, but not without grave suspicions of what might lie ahead.
We will never again, any of us here, be isolated from one another, in exile and unreachable.
I stopped, taking the time to meet the eyes of each and every one present.
We must all promise. We must maintain our lines of communication, and we must seek to see how we may benefit from one another as a united people, for that is what we are now. Not so much the children of darkness, but the people of the savage garden, because we have come of age as such.
I stopped. People of the savage garden. I didn't know if it was the right or ultimate term for us. I had to think on that. The matter of an ultimate term. Consult, listen to the inevitable poetry that would rise to create a term from all the tribe. For now I had done the best that I could do. There was so much more to be done. But I was tired, raggedly tired. I motioned that I needed a moment to collect my thoughts, and I was startled to hear a soft applause break out in the room that soon included everyone, it seemed, and then died away quietly. So much more to say. I thought again of Magnus, that ghost, Magnus who'd come to me in the golden caves of Sephrain's little city in Cappadocia. I thought of Gremt, the grand spirit who had been there too. "And we must take up one more matter now," I said. "It's the matter of the Talamasca. It's the matter of what they've made known to me and Sephrain about their members."
"And to me as well," said Pandora. "I've met Gremt, as I know you have, the spirit who in fact brought the Talamasca into being."
"And I too have been contacted by them," said Marius. "And a meeting with them soon might be to the benefit of us all."
Again I listened for Armel, but there was only silence, and a warm, subtle embrace under my skin that let me know he was there. I was looking down. I waited.
"Learning, Prince Lestat," he said in the lowest whisper. "Learning, as I have never dreamed it was possible to learn."
I looked up. "Yes, and we will indeed meet with them, meet with those who've revealed themselves to us, and we will determine, among other things, how to treat the old ongoing mortal order of the Talamasca, whom these spectral founding fathers have apparently cut loose to pursue its own destiny." Seth was marveling, obviously wanting to know so much more on this. "Now, if there's nothing more," I said, "I'd like to retire. I've made that French library my lair, and it's waiting for me, and I need to rest perhaps more now than ever before in my life."
"One thing more," said Seth. "You hold the core now. You are the source. You are the primal fount."
"Yes," I responded calmly, patiently, waiting.
"Your fate is our fate," he said.
"Yes."
"You must vow never to slip away from us, never to seek to hide from us, never to be careless with your own person, any more than any earthly monarch on whom the peace of a realm depends."
"I'm aware of that," I said. I suppressed a little flash of anger. "I am yours now," I said, as difficult as it was to say this. A chill ran through me, an awful foreboding. "I belong to the realm, I know." Suddenly Everard spoke up, the young blood drinker from Italy.
"But is this thing quiet inside you now?" he asked. "Is he quiet?"
A ripple of alarm ran through the gathering, though why, I'm not sure. This question was on the mind of nearly everyone here. It had to be.
"Yes, Amel is quiet," I said. "Amel is satisfied. Amel is at peace."
"Or maybe he's somewhere else at this very moment, perhaps," said my mother.
"Yes," said Everard, "off making some more horrible trouble."
"No," I replied.
"But why?" asked Rosamandis. "Why is he content?"
It was said with total sincerity, and for the first time in his face I saw a glimmer of actual pain. I reflected for a moment before responding. Then,
"Because he can see, and he can hear more clearly than ever," I said, "and this is what he's longed for. That's what he has always wanted, to see and hear and know in this world, the physical world, our world. And he is watching and learning as never before."
"But surely," said Zenobia, the diminutive friend of Gregory, "he saw and heard when he was in Akasha all that time, before Makari ever came."
"No," I said, "he didn't, because in those times he didn't know how."
Pause. The various amazing minds of the room pondered. Inside me, Amel gave the softest, most eloquent laugh with nothing of humor in it, and everything of wonder that I could hope to hear. I raised my hands for patience. I had to sleep, and the morning was creeping up on the young ones with its sly, burning fingers, and it would soon be creeping up even on me. Rose and Victor, I said, this day will be your last on earth when the sun is visible to you, and when the sun is your friend. I felt a sudden throb in my heart. I swallowed, trying to keep my voice steady. Spend this day however you wish, but be wise and stay safe and come home to us at sunset, to reaffirm your decision. I saw my son beaming at me, and beside him Rose looking on in quiet wonder. I smiled. I put my fingers gently to my lips and let the silent kiss go. I left the room quickly. It would be time to embrace them and to weep, yes, to weep as I held their warm, tender, mortal bodies in my arms, only some 13 hours from now, when the night threw its inevitable mantle once again across the great savage garden that was our world. As I lay down to sleep in the French library, I spoke softly to Amma. "You're quiet," I said. "Strangely quiet, but I know you are there." "Yes, I'm here," he said. "And it's as you told them. Do you doubt your own explanation?" There was a pause, but I knew he was going to say something more. "Years ago," he said, "when you were a mortal boy in your village in France, you had a friend. A friend you loved." "Nicholas," I said. "And you and he would talk?" "Yes. By the hour, by the day, by the night, by the week and the month. Yes, always in those days when we were boys together, we would talk. Do you remember what you called it? Your long, flowing exchange?" "Our conversation," I said. I marveled that he knew. Did he know because I knew? Could he search through my memory when I wasn't remembering? I was drowsy and my eyes were closing. "Our conversation," I said again, and it went on and on. "Well, we are having our conversation, aren't we?" he asked. "And our conversation will go on forever. There is no need for haste." A great warmth came over me as if I'd been wrapped in a blanket of love. "Yes," I whispered. "Yes."
29. Lestat. Pomp and Circumstance. At sunset, the word went out that I would come before all in the park, at a deserted location well hidden from the mortal world. And as I set out to go, dressed in a new red velvet coat and black pants and nice, spiffy mid-calf boots generously provided by Armand, along with some old-fashioned lace at my throat, I discovered that Seth and Gregory were coming with me, that under no circumstances would they allow the prince to walk amongst his people unguarded. Thorn and Flavius also accompanied us without a word. I accepted it. There were perhaps 75 fledglings in the gathering at 8 o'clock, and I had little difficulty greeting each with a clasp of hands and a promise that we would all work together to prosper. All had been young mortals when made, most dressed in black, some elegantly in old romantic 19th-century jackets or dresses, and others in the most exquisite black fashions of the present time, and still others were ragged, unkempt, with matted hair, but all surrounded me with open hearts, with touching willingness to follow me and what I might demand. And one or two older ones were there too, blood drinkers as old as Louis or myself. But there was no one older. Taking a position in the middle of a circle, I explained that I was now their prince, and I wouldn't fail them. I did not tell them yet that I contained the sacred core. I saw no reason for that to be announced in vulgar fashion in such a place, or for it to be announced by me personally at all. But I did assure them that the rampage of the voice had been ended. The darkness was soothing here, and there was a certain quiet, with the distant buildings of Manhattan flanking the park on either side, and the overhanging trees partially concealing us. But I knew I had to be quick,
There were curious mortals about, and I wanted no disruption. I told them all now that they were to be assured of my guidance. I'll soon set up my court, to which you can come at any time, with rooms there for wayfarers, and all wayfarers. And the voice of Benji Mahmud will never cease to offer you invaluable counsel. But if we are to cease from all battles and gang wars, and to live in secrecy and harmony with one another, then there must be rules, the very things I fought all my life, rules, and there must be a willingness on your part, for your own sake, to obey them. Again came that soft but mighty roar I'd heard from them on the sidewalk before the townhouse only a night ago. "You must leave this city," I said. "You must not congregate any more before Trinity Gate. Please, I ask that you agree to this." There were nods, cries of affirmation, of yes from all sides. "This city," I said, "great as it is, cannot sustain so many hunters, and you must find hunting grounds where you can feed on the evildoer and leave the innocent unmolested. Understand. This you have to do, and there is no escaping it." Again came their chorus of praise and agreement. So eager, so innocent they seemed, so charged with collective conviction. "There is no reason under the moon and stars," I said, "why we cannot prosper, and prosper we will." A louder roar, and the innermost circle pressing in, even as Gregory and Seth gestured for them to hold where they were. "Now give me time," I said. "Give me opportunity. Wait to hear from me, and I promise your patience will be rewarded. And spread the word far and wide that I am your leader now, and you can trust in me and what we will all achieve together." I then took my leave, once again clasping hands on both sides, as Gregory, Seth, Flavius, and Thorne escorted me out of the park. We ignored a deluge of irrepressible questions I could not answer now. When I entered the townhouse, I saw in the drawing room the unmistakable figures of Gremt, Stryker Knowles, and Magnus, along with an impressive white-haired ancient blood-drinker, and other ghosts, striking ghosts, as solid and real-seeming as Magnus. The shining and cheerful ghost of Raymond Gallant was among them. Had he met with Marius? I certainly hoped so, but Marius wasn't there. Armand was with them, and so were Louis and Severin, and they all stared silently at me as I came into the room. I was alarmed at the sight of this ancient blood-drinker, simply because he hadn't come to us before. But I could see at once, by the manner of everyone present, that this was some sort of decorous or amicable meeting, and Seth and Gregory didn't follow me, but remained in the hallway, with Flavius and Thorne. But they did not seem concerned. Gremt and Magnus were robed as before, but this ancient blood-drinker who gave me his name telepathically as Tescommon wore a handsome modern suit of clothes. The other ghosts were all attired in the same way, except for the one woman ghost who wore a fashionable long dress and a slim black coat. The group was very simply astonishing. Did Louis and Armand know these were ghosts? Did they know this Gremt was a spirit? And who was this Tescommon, a blood-drinker who knew these ghosts, obviously, but hadn't made himself known to us until now? After a moment's hesitation, Louis left the company, and Armand stepped back into the shadows. Severin gave a warm embrace to the blood-drinker, and then took her leave as well. The clock was chiming the half-hour. I had only 30 minutes to be with Rose and Victor. I approached Gremt. I realized that the first time I'd encountered this spirit, I found him intimidating. I hadn't admitted it to myself, but I knew it now because I was not in any way afraid of him, and a certain definite liking of him arose in me, a certain warming to him because I had seen emotions in him that I understood. He wasn't without emotion now. "You know what's happened," I said. He was staring at me intently. Staring, and perhaps staring through me, and through my eyes at Amal. I couldn't know. But Amal was quiet. Amal was there as he always would be, but not a sound came from him. And not a sound came from Gremt, either. That this being was in fact a spirit and not some species of biological immortal was almost impossible to grasp as I looked at him. he appeared so very vital, and so complex, and obviously filled with feeling. He was not at ease.
"Soon," I said, "I want to talk to you, to sit down with you, if you will, and talk, with you and Magnus here, and all of your little company. I'm going home as soon as I can, to my father's house in France, in the country where I was born. Will you come to us there?" Again, no response. And then Grant seemed to pull himself up, to force himself to be alert, and he gave a little shiver, and then spoke.
"Yes," said Grant. "Yes, thank you, most definitely. We want very much to do that. Forgive us for interrupting you without warning. I realize that you're expected elsewhere. It's only that we could not stay away." The blood drinker, Tescarman, a spare, white-haired being of considerable elegance, stepped forward. He introduced himself again with a soft, agreeable voice.
"Yes, you will forgive us, I hope, for coming to you so unexpectedly. But you see, we are so eager for a meeting, and simply could not, after what has happened, remain away."
What did they know of what had happened? But then, of course, they knew. How could they not? Ghosts, spirits, what limits were there to what they could know? For all I knew, they'd been in the house, present invisibly, when I had taken Amelin to me. But it did seem this Tescarman wanted to put me at ease.
"Lestat," he said warmly, "we are the ancient elders of the Talamasca. You've been told this. We are the founders of the Order. In a sense, we are the real Talamasca, and the enduring Talamasca, no longer in need of the mortal order that survives. And we want to talk with you very much."
Armand, standing silently against the wall, said and did nothing. "Well, I couldn't be more eager to talk to you myself," I said, "and I understand why you came, and I suspect I understand why you've cut loose your mortal scholars. I think I do, at any rate. But I need time to prepare my home in France before I see you, and I ask that you come to me there, and soon."
"My name is Hesketh," said the woman. "We are so longing for this meeting. We can't tell you how very much we want it."
She had her smooth blonde hair swept back from her face in rather beautiful waves, held in place by bits of pearl and platinum, and then flowing over her shoulders in a timeless fashion. She extended to me a gloved hand, a hand covered in soft grey kid leather, and of course it felt as vital as a human hand. I could feel the deceptive pulse in it. Why did they make themselves so perfectly physical? Her eyes were arresting, not only because they were such a dark shade of grey, but because they were a little wider apart than most people's eyes, and that gave her face a certain mystery. All the details of her, eyelashes, eyebrows, succulent lips, were exquisitely convincing and fetching. I had to wonder precisely what accounted for this and the other gorgeous illusions I was seeing here. Was it skill, magnetism, aesthetic depth, genius? Was it the soul? The other ghosts hung back, and one of them, a very personable young male, rather husky, with dark olive skin and curling black hair, appeared to have been weeping. I couldn't help notice that Armand was almost directly behind him, and rather close to him, but there was no time for me to be noticing all these things, or puzzling over them.
"What makes us the physical beings we are? It is all of those things," said Grant, responding directly to my thoughts, and of course reminding me that he could do this. "Oh, we have so much to tell you. So much to... And we will come to you in France as soon as you tell us to come. We have a house there not very far at all from yours, a very old house that goes back to our earliest times together." He was cheerful suddenly, and almost excited. "This has been our wish for so long." He stopped as if he'd said too much, but his expression never really changed. The ghost of Magnus, as solid as before, hung back, but there came from his face a look of love, of doting love. This caught me off guard.
"Listen, my friends," I said, "there are important things happening under this roof tonight, and I cannot invite you to remain and to sit down with us just now. You must trust me, and trust in my good will. But soon, under my roof in France, it's agreed, we will indeed come together. We were repeating ourselves, weren't we? This was like a dance.
Yes, said Grant, but his eyes were almost glazed, as though his physicality was as much at the mercy of his emotions and obsessions as that of a human.
Yet he didn't move to take his leave. None of them did. And suddenly I caught on.